I'm going to talk today about three things. I'm going to start by talking about Snow Lab, a little bit about why it's there, and the first question that got answered underground in this mine in Sudbury, and a question about how the sun shines. Then I'm going to go to expand a little bit, talk about the big picture in the universe, and then I'm going to scale down a bit. And I thought I was going to make the first Monty Python reference of the day, but I guess it's the second. My talk is rather like Ann Elk's Theory of the Brontosaurus. It's going to be smaller scale at one end, much, much bigger scale in the middle, and small again at the far end. All these questions have sort of a couple of themes that ties them together. One of them is we're thinking about them in Sudbury. And the other is looking at stuff we can't see and how we do that. So let's start with how the sun shines. We certainly can see the sun. There are nuclear reactions in the core of the sun. And I know your school teachers and you're trained to tell your students not to use Wikipedia. For the love of God, tell them to use Wikipedia. Especially for technical questions, everything I've looked up related to the work I do has been accurate. There's a nuclear reaction in the core, produces heat, and it also produces neutrinos. And the heat works its way to the core of the sun through radiation and convection. Just heat comes out. And the heat comes out in the radiation from the surface. Okay. So if you have a furnace and you have insulation around it with a given R value, you can work out how much heat comes out the outside. Same thing you can do with, if you know how much heat's coming out the outside, and we know how much heat's coming off the sun. At the Earth, it's about 100 watts per square meter. And you know what the sun is made of, and that's actually a hard part. You have to find meteorites from the very, very early days of the solar system and work out what their composition is. You can effectively work out the R value, if you like, of the insulation in this region, and knowing how much heat comes out, you know what the sun is, you know how hot the sun's furnace is. It's a little more complicated than that because it changes with time as hydrogen's burned into helium, but that's effectively what you do. And everything we know about the sun before the days of neutrinos came from the surface. And that's a lot. We know it's round, and that's not a small point. The fact that it's round actually makes the math much easier because there's only one variable that matters, and that's radius. It's not quite true when you look at magnetism, solar magnetism, but in terms of heat production, that's true. We know its surface temperature. It's about 6,000 degrees because it's yellow hot. We know the composition of the surface. One thing I didn't put on here is we know the sun is ringing like a bell and there's pressure waves around the sun by looking at Doppler lines. And actually from that, you can work out what the speed of sound is as a function of depth in the sun as these waves work their way around the sun. But it's still a surface observation from which you infer what's going on inside. So there were experiments measuring neutrinos from the sun. Well, what's a neutrino? A neutrino is a subatomic particle. It's made in some nuclear reactions, weak nuclear reactions. And people had an idea 40 or 50 years ago. It was Ray Davis and John Bacall. John Bacall did the theory work, and Ray Davis did the experiment. They put a several tons of dry cleaning fluid in the mine in South Dakota. The chlorine in the dry cleaning fluid was a target for neutrinos. The neutrinos struck the chlorine, turned it into argon. They extracted a few atoms of argon from this dry cleaning fluid, tons of it. That's a fun chemistry problem. And concentrated the argon into a counter and waited while the argon decayed because it created a radioactive form of argon. And from that, they were able to count how many times solar neutrinos hit chlorine. From knowing how strongly neutrinos ought to interact with chlorine, they were able to work out how many neutrinos were coming from the sun. And they got one-third what the astrophysicists were predicting. And back in the day, that was, you know, considered pretty good. However, the astrophysicists just kept doing work. and showing that, no, actually, it really was a third. It wasn't one. And they refined their model, and they kept taking more data, and it came in consistently at a third. And then a Japanese experiment, Kamioka experiment, went looking for solar neutrinos, and it found a half. And it was a half. It wasn't one. And as they took more data, that data were robust. And so this is known as a solar neutrino problem. And Herb Chen, the late Herb Chen of UC Irvine, realized that what you really wanted to do to solve this problem, because people do want to know how the sun shines and they do want to know about neutrinos, is use heavy water as your target for neutrinos. And the reason to use heavy water is pretty simple. There's more than one type of neutrino. There's a neutrino produced in the sun, and there's two other types. So the electron neutrino is produced in the sun, because it's paired in the nuclear reaction with electrons. And there's also muon and tau type neutrinos that had been measured. Well, muon had been measured by this point. And so they knew they were there. And the question is something happening to the neutrinos? In other words, is it turning from an electron neutrino into a muon neutrino? Or is it just not being produced? So Herb Chen suggested that heavy water would be able to, with two reactions, measure in one reaction just the electron type neutrinos, and in the other reaction, every type of neutrinos. And that would answer why the number of neutrinos measured didn't jive with the solar models. So I'm going to show a clip from the video, but this is where the neutrino observatory is. This is Creighton Mine. Creighton Mine is about 20 kilometers west of Sudbury, Ontario, so get in the car and drive 4 hours north. And it's in the Canadian Shield. 1.9 billion years ago, there was a meteor impact that broke up and melted a lot of rock, and nickel and copper came up and seeped their way up all the way to the surface, and it's one of the richest ore deposits in the world. And so this is all very active mining here, and this is where our experiment is, 2 kilometers of rock above us. And I'll get into why we're underground in a bit. So the original snow experiment, here's kind of a schematic view. It's an acrylic flask. And when I say acrylic flask, I mean a big acrylic flask. It's 12 meters in diameter. It holds 1,000 tons of heavy water. It is surrounded by light water for two reasons. First of all, you need to hold up the heavy water. And heavy water is, well, a little heavier than light water. So you can hold up most of the weight just by immersing it in light water, and then the rest is held up with some ropes. This is a fisheye lens at the bottom. So we have the end result of the neutrino interactions is a burst of light, which I'll get to in the next two slides. But just before the last panel of light detectors was put in at the very bottom, somebody with a fisheye camera clicked a photo. And that's what this image is, a fisheye lens looking up. That is the opening at the top where we introduce calibration sources and whatnot. This is what it looks like from the outside. This looks rather clean. This construction platform, of course, is taken down. Each one of these photomultiplier tubes, and there were 9,600 of them to measure the light, needed a cable. That was a fun job. Actually, it was kind of a fun job. You got to hang down there and work up platforms and do up cables. And the trick was getting the right cable on the right PMP. We used a barcode scanner. So you put on the cable finger tight, scan the barcode on the cable, scan the barcode on the PMP. If you heard a happy sound, you tightened it. If you heard an unhappy sound, you took it off and put it where it belonged. We got them mostly right, which is good. So how do you detect neutrinos in heavy water? Well, that, of course, what makes heavy water heavy is that it's deuterium. It's not H2O, it's D2O. So you get the extra neutron in the deuteron. And that's what makes it a wonderful target for neutrinos. Because an electron-type neutrino from the sun can break the deuteron in half. You get two protons. The electron neutrino is absorbed. And if you absorb an electron neutrino, you must produce an electron. And the electron goes flying off. Now, the electron goes flying off with quite a good velocity. 0.9999 C. It's got an energy of, oh, roughly for these events, say 10 million electron volts. So its total energy is 20 times its mass. So it's going at a pretty good clip. And it's going faster than light travels in water. Okay, not faster than light, but faster than light travels in water. So you end up with a shockwave being produced. That shockwave is called analogous to a sonic boom. The geometry of it's identical. The electron only travels about this far before it stops. So you get a shockwave of light coming off from just effectively a point. That shockwave comes off in a cone. And this is actual data. This circle show you the photomultiplier tubes that got hit in a nice ring-like pattern. Some of the light gets scattered or reflected. So you also get some light behind you. And that that's what a neutrino interacting in snow looks like. So that's great, because this tells you about the electron-type neutrino, which is what's created in the sun. This is the third to a half. I'll get to that. But yeah, so the third is, there were two experiments done before, well, more than two, but the two that I mentioned, one got an answer of a third and one got an answer of a half. And I'll explain why they got a slightly different answer in the next slide. So the neutrino can also come in and hit a deuteron and just break it in half. The neutrino goes flying off and is undetected. The proton and the neutron go wandering about in the water. We added a little bit of salt to the water for one phase of the experiment. We also added other neutron detectors for another phase. The neutron captures on the chlorine. The chlorine in the process emits a cascade of gamma rays, and there's a font problem, so the gamma became an epsilon. But anyway, these are a series of gamma rays. Those gamma rays interact in the water, scatter off electrons. Those electrons are fast. They produce Cherenkov light. You get a signal. So from this, we can measure all types of neutrinos. And we also used, as I say, we actually looked at the neutrons three different ways, because that's the part of the experiment that we really had to get right. So what happened with SNOW? And SNOW stopped taking data in 2006. And the final students are finishing up their PhD theses now. And if you like, the computer guy whose job it was to make sure the SNOW data was properly archived and whatnot, he's now employed by SNOW Lab, not SNOW. So in a sense, the final employees of SNOW are now working on different projects. And the final students are finishing, and the final papers are being written up. The total number of neutrinos we measured jives beautifully with solar models within uncertainty, within about 5 or 8%. So we really do understand how the sun shines. The electron neutrinos that we measured are 30 plus or minus 3% of the total. So something was happening to the neutrinos from the sun. The electron neutrinos that were measured on Earth is only a third of what the predicted number was. The neutrinos were changing from one to the other. One of the reasons why people thought this might be happening was the fact that the Japanese experiment measured half and the chlorine experiment measured a third. The Japanese experiment was able to measure muon-type neutrinos also with a much reduced sensitivity. So they didn't get one. That reduced sensitivity to the muon neutrinos bumped them up from a third to a half. But the uncertainties were pretty big. So, you know, they were still only about three sigma apart. So the interesting thing about all of this is there are some implications for this. I mean, and the first one is we really do know how the sun shines, which I think is kind of cool. That's been 5,000 years of human intellectual history. We actually know the answer. We know the answer because we've measured the heat produced in the core of the sun directly. And I think that's kind of neat. Neutrinos change flavor. Neutrinos have lots of interesting properties. And there's all sorts of speculative places this takes you. One of them is, and I'll just throw this out, why is there ordinary stuff in the universe? Right? You know there's matter and antimatter, and they're supposed to be the same, but they can't be exactly the same, because if matter and antimatter were exactly the same, they'd have created equal amounts in the Big Bang, and we'd end up with nothing. But we didn't end up with nothing. We ended up with us, which I view as a good thing. And so there's some slight asymmetry between matter and antimatter. Neutrinos might play a role in that, and neutrinos being able to change flavor is a prerequisite for that. Neutrinos have a mass. We don't actually, from neutrino oscillation experiments, measure the neutrino mass. We actually measure the difference between neutrino masses. But even with that, we know that neutrinos don't have enough mass to be the dark matter. And there's cool pictures and lots of write-ups on this on the SNOW website. And I threw the word dark matter at you, so it's time now to get to the big part of the Brontosaurus and look at the universe as a whole. So we have something completely bizarre going on, because I'm going to make three completely contradictory statements. These two jive, that's why they're in green. I'm going to claim that we have measured the age of the universe to better than a percent. And we can trace the history of the universe to, to a percent. And if you want to do geometry on the scale of the observable universe, you can. And that we've measured a triangle on the scale of the observable universe. And that triangle has 180 degrees inside it. So in other words, we know that the universe's geometry is what you guys teach in high school. It's not the geometry of a sphere, right? If you and I start out on the equator, I start in South America and you start in Africa, and we both travel north, we're traveling parallel, but we meet at the North Pole. Parallel lines meet on a sphere. If we start out on a horse's saddle, on the sides of a horse's saddle, and we keep walking parallel, we get farther apart. Now, I'm going to claim to you that, in fact, parallel lines don't meet, and that we've measured that on the scale of the observable universe. So we must know what's going on. There's only one minor problem. We don't actually know what the universe is made of, which is a little disturbing. Which, quite frankly, can make these first two claims sound a little arrogant. However, they're data-based. So, I mean, we could be horribly wrong, but I doubt it, because we've measured this stuff. In 1991, I took a class called Physics of the Early Universe, and it was a great class. But we really only did one detailed calculation from start to finish. And that was, we worked out how much hydrogen or deuterium, helium, and lithium got made after the Big Bang, when the universe was, if you like, one big giant star making the elements heavier than hydrogen. And the reason we spent so much time doing that is it was the only thing we could calculate and compare to data. The only thing. Then something wonderful happened in 1992, and then it just got better and better and better. The point I'm trying to make here is that now cosmology is data-driven. And what I'm going to show you when I show you stuff is data, not theory. And the data has lots of forms. It doesn't just come from one source. It comes from four forms. So here's the history of the universe that I claim we know. And I took this from the European Space Agency's Blue Book for the Planck mission, which is actually a great thing to read for an intro on cosmology. The universe started here. This is pretty speculative. This is moving up on some weird logarithmic time scale. You did the nucleosynthesis here 3 minutes in. Okay, we can measure the amount of hydrogen and helium and deuterium and lithium away from stars and work out, you know, how and check calculations of that against data. Something marvelous happened here, which I'm going to go into a lot of details later, and that is hydrogen and helium ions became neutral. And that was really wonderful. Early structure formation, you got started making galaxies. And then we started, stars got into second and third generations, and you ended up with primates holding hockey sticks. So before the universe became transparent, and this is this business of hydrogen and helium becoming neutral. Driving in a thick fog is dangerous. There's lots of light, but you can't see anything. Okay. So when the universe was young, 130,000 years or so, and hot, the hydrogen and helium gas was ionized. Okay. And ionized, of course, means charged. And charged means that light is going to scatter off it like crazy. So there was lots of light in the early universe, and the light kept scattering off of the hydrogen and helium gas. And it scattered off the hydrogen and helium gas so much that the mean free path was very short. And very, very, very importantly, that radiation was in good thermal contact with the gas. If the gas was more energetic, you know, it could transfer energy to the radiation and vice versa. So you had a very, very nice thermal equilibrium. And not only a very nice thermal equilibrium, the best thermal equilibrium ever. This process is completely understood. Okay, you can measure it in the lab. We know exactly how it works. So the universe, this is going on, the universe is expanding and cooling because expanding things cool. You know that. Back in the bad old days when people used aerosol antiperspirant, it was a good way to wake yourself up in the morning. It was a cool blast, right? And that's just expansion. Cools things. So the universe, and the key point here is that we can see each other. Neutral gas is transparent. Okay? So the universe cooled, and the hydrogen and helium formed atoms, and the collisions between the hydrogen and helium wasn't enough to ionize it, and the light was able to free stream. What color was the light? Well, we know what color the light was. It's a thermal black body radiation. It's just thermal radiation off of something at the temperature of hydrogen and helium as they go neutral. So we know exactly what the light was. So let's go look for that light. And right now, because the universe has expanded a great deal since then, that light is in the radio waves. And this is the 1992 data from the COBE satellite. And there's data points and error bars, and they're smaller than the curve. This is the best measured thermal black body ever. Okay, you could put the best radiation detector in some perfectly pitch black coal in a completely dark room, it's not as good a black body as this. Okay, this is pretty much bang on perfect. It's so bang on perfect that actually what's interesting is not the fact that it's bang on perfect, but the tiny deviations from it. And that's what I want to talk about now. And so when you look at the black body radiation curve right now, it's shown in plots like this from the WMAP satellite, where that's a whole sky projected onto one image. And they've played games with the color scale, as described beautifully by my friend Hugh using a stove, that if you wanted to make the stove look terrible, you'd have a color scale where 0 to 4,000 degrees was purple and more than 4,000 degrees was red, and the stove wouldn't look like much. But if he changed the color scale, his stove would begin to look like a stove. Okay. He has a great blog, and I recommend you read it. His mom is a writer, very, very smart woman, with very little science training, and she wanted to know why he did what he did. So we started answering her questions in this blog. So it's well worth a read. So this sky map, this is a temperature map of the whole sky. So what's that saying is, if we take that black body spectrum and look over there and look over there, we're looking two directions in the sky, how close or how far apart are they, like the temperature? Is it the same temperature or is it a different temperature? And it's the same temperature to one part in 10,000. So I've really, if you like, jacked up the color scale. So that green in the middle is 2.725 whatever degrees. Blue is cooler by 2/10,000 of a degree. And red is warmer by 2/10,000 of a degree. Okay? You really have to play games with the color scale to see this. However, it's absolutely fascinating. Because if you look, here and here is kind of the same. The differences come on small angles. In fact, if you plot the difference as a function of angle, or since you're science teachers, if you do a multiple expansion and you look at the bipole and quadrupole terms and all that, you actually find that all the power, or most of the power, is in the, say, 220th multipole moment, or all the power is at an angular scale of 1 degree. That's where the fluctuation is. If you want to know, get the biggest change in the cosmic microwave background, you look 1 degree apart. Well, why do you look 1 degree apart? This is just the gas, right? It's a gas we understand. It's a gas with a known speed of sound. It's a gas with pressure waves going through it. It's a gas with completely understood physics. So if you have a wave traveling through the gas, some pressure fluctuation, you can know how fast that ought to be traveling. And you can measure. And so you should be able to know from the properties of your material, physically, like in meters, how far apart 1 degree is, how far apart, say, that red and that blue is. You should be able to work that out. So you know that 1 degree, triangle that opens 1 degree, you know the distance at the far end of the triangle. Well, if you know the distance at the far end of the triangle is 1 degree, and you know the distance to the triangle, and you know the distance to the triangle because the universe is expanded from the temperature at which hydrogen is hot and ionized to the temperature of 2.75 degrees, you can work out what expansion that is in the wavelength of light, and that tells you the distance. So you know the distance to that radiation has come. You know it's got an opening angle of 1 degree. You have a triangle. You can do geometry on the scale of the entire observable universe, which is kind of neat. Okay? And you know something else, too. You know how the waves travel. You know, I mean, you know what makes musical instruments sound good, right? When you play a 440 string on a violin, 440 hertz doesn't sound good. 440 plus a certain amount of 880 plus a certain amount of whatever else comes out of the violin sounds good. You can actually work out not just this, the primary. You actually can work out the overtones. You can measure all the overtones. So actually, you can work out the acoustics of the early universe, if you like. You can work out how the universe must be made of, how heavy the particles are and whatnot. And that tells you the relative heights of the various overtones, tells you stuff about the composition. The other thing, too, is for all that I've gone on about the fluctuation, please let's remember this is astonishingly flat. I've blown the scale up like crazy. This is data from the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. Okay. You take a telescope and you automate it. Okay. You take a telescope, you put it in the desert in Arizona, nice big telescope, you point it at the sky, only instead of having each pixel on the camera, each pixel is, if you like, a little optical fiber that goes to a spectrograph. So for each pixel, you measure the entire frequency spectrum, and you scan the sky. And you do this in a completely automated way. And based on your analysis using the pixels in the sky and the redshifts of the stars and spectra of the stars, you do an analysis, and you can work out as a function of position in the sky how far away things are based on the Doppler shifts of the lines and whatnot, how fast they're moving away from you. Or if you like, the redshift, which is the cosmological measure of distance. The farther something is away, the more the light has been stretched out traveling through the expanding universe. And here's the Earth in the middle, or I guess more to the point, Sloan Digital Sky Survey Telescope in the middle. And here's distance, and you'll notice that that ain't smooth. It's sea sponge-like. You've got bubbles, you've got where there's nothing going on, and then structure comes together in sheets and it points. And you've got really quite a rich structure. How do you go from something smooth at one part in 10,000 to something with that much structure? And you can't using light stuff like neutrinos and protons and whatnot. You need something heavier. It needs to be heavy because that means it's traveling slower at a given energy. And if it's traveling fast, it doesn't clump. If it's traveling slowly, it has a chance to clump up. You need something to seed that clumping, like dark matter. The other neat thing about dark matter is galaxies don't obey Kepler's laws. Okay, so when you teach about Kepler's laws and, you know, you make people calculate the period of Jupiter's orbit, knowing its distance or whatever, you're making the assumption, of course, that all the mass is in the middle. And that's how Kepler's law works. So, of course, you look at this galaxy, all the mass is in the middle. So you correct it a little bit, but basically the mass is in the middle. Minor corrections of stuff you can see. And you look at the velocity of these stars. This would be a terrible galaxy to look at the velocities of stars because we're looking at it like a pancake. You want to look at it edge on, and your galaxy is rotating like this, and these Doppler lines will be, these lines will be Doppler shifted. I guess that would be blue, and these ones would be red, and you work out the velocity as a function of radius, and you get the wrong answer. It's not Kepler. It's not even close. Okay? It is as if this galaxy is buried in a mass, say, 5 times bigger than the galaxy, which is big. I love this picture. Astronomy picture of the day. You all know about it, right? So I don't need to advertise it. Okay. So what you need to understand about this picture is that this is one thing. Okay? And that one thing isn't the foreground, that's the background. Okay? I see people nodding, so I'm glad to see you've surfed this page before. It's a great thing. This is a quasar. It is a long way back. Your eyes are the Hubble Space Telescope. This screen, this cluster of galaxies is a big screen, okay? And your eyes are the Hubble telescope. So the cluster in the middle is making the lens and bending the light. And so there are different lines of sight from the quasar back there that let the light through this to your eyes. And those lines of sight give us multiple images of this quasar. And a grad student in relativity, i.e. not me, but any grad student here, should be able to tell you how heavy this needs to be to bend the light that much. And the answer is about 4 times. Okay. So we have a cosmic pie chart that the universe is made of the heavy stuff, a little tiny bit, a few neutrinos, just a tiny fraction, stars, a bigger fraction, free hydrogen and helium in interstellar space, slightly bigger fraction, dark matter, term of ignorance, don't know what it is, and the truly weird dark energy, which I haven't talked about because I don't have time, and it's just so bizarre. But dark energy is something which seems to give gravity a repulsive component as well as an attractive component. And I just, let's not go there. There are actually people here who can do a better job probably of explaining it than I. And I want to get back now to the thin end of the Brontosaurus. Snow was here. So these questions are coming up and they've been percolating, and in 2001 snow was running, or 2002 snow was running smoothly. Papers were getting written. People sat around and thought, what's next? There was a contest in Canada by CFI for research infrastructure, and they said, you know, there's all these other experiments that we're going to want to do when snow's done. Let's ask to build a lab. And CFI said yes. So we expanded the lab, including these areas. So this, by the way, is the size of a 10-story building, largest cavern of its depth in the world. This is about two-thirds that size, and this is a little bit smaller. And then there's medium-sized lab space here. And by medium-sized lab space, each one of these segments is probably twice the size of this building. Or this room, not this building, this room. This is mining. And so why do we want to look for dark matter in the Earth and here? Well, it's one of the pillars of our program. So dark matter exists around galaxies. That's where they rotate funny. It must have been created in the early universe. So it must, you must be able to interact with it in some way. The interaction rates to make the dark matter is consistent with a weak interaction force. In other words, the same interaction that neutrinos do. That's great. We don't need to invent new physics, just a new particle. It requires a similar skill set that we had to do on the neutrino experiment. So it's the right thing for us to be doing. So we have two first dark matter experiments that are running right now, and these are prototypes for larger experiments we're going to build. And I'm going to talk a bit about deep later. But I want to get to the hard question to answer. And that is, if you see a signal in an experiment, you're looking for something no one's seen before, how do you know it's not a conventional interaction that mimics dark matter? Or in math, what is the probability of getting a background event in your signal that mimics your signal in a given experiment? And we want to develop experiments with on order 0.1 background events per ton of detector material per year. That's kind of hard. Backgrounds come from cosmic rays. That's why we're underground. The rock filters it out. Comes from radon and radon daughters. Radon's in the air. It's a noble gas. It gets everywhere. And neutrons are particularly bad. So this should just start. Do I have to hit play? There are 50 cosmic rays on surface going through your brain every second.
Because Earth blocks most of these rays, many dark matter detectors are located deep underground.
So what we do is we get underground in Snow Lab, 6,800 feet below ground, where the cosmic ray signal is hugely reduced, and it's a much better environment for doing an experiment for a rare event like a dark matter scatter off.
At Snow Lab in Ontario, Canada, several dark matter experiments are in development.
The main challenge, and it's not only for us, but for all dark matter search experiments, the direct search experiments, is the backgrounds. The backgrounds are particles that we know of, they are around us, but we don't want them close to our detectors. So basically, we have to shield our detectors from these particles.
One team of researchers hopes to detect winds within a superheated liquid.
We have a gel with millions and millions of small droplets of a freon inside. So when there is an interaction of a particle inside of these droplets, this interaction might put enough energy for this phenomenon to happen inside the droplet. So you have an explosion. So the droplet that's liquid becomes a gas bubble. And we can hear this explosion using acoustic sensors.
So I think most of you have seen that at some point. I'm going to skip through some things we work in glove boxes purged with nitrogen gas. Deep and Clean, I work on the Deep Clean project. It's a series of 4 experiments, 2 prototypes, 1 at Yale, 1 underground at Snow Lab, and we're building 2 large-scale experiments to look for dark matter. And the Clean does a few other things. I'm going to briefly go through this. We are going to go in this new cube hall, which is now completely painted, and the 2 experiments will go here. And so this experiment will have 3.5 tons of liquid argon. I'll get to the joys of liquid argon in a moment, in a tank of water. And the water shields against radiation. Why water? Well, you can make water very clean. Your shield against radiation is no good if it is itself is radioactive. Secondly, we're worried about neutrons, because neutrons will mimic a dark matter signal. And you know that if you throw a bowling ball at a marble, you don't stop the bowling ball. Similarly, if you throw a marble at a bowling ball, it'll deflect, but it'll keep going. So you want your shielding material to have the same mass as the neutron. And a proton, of course, has the same mass. So plastic and water make very good shields for neutrons. We'll skip over that. So what I want to talk about is July 4, 2008, because things ended up going well. And I'm not going to call it a typical day, but it's a day that illustrates a lot of what we do. So it sort of has 3 or 4 typical days all mushed into 12 hours. We were building the Deep One prototype detector, and Deep One is a test bed for many technologies we're using on the big experiment and getting some science out of it too. We use liquid argon to detect dark matter. Basically, the idea is dark matter hits liquid argon, the liquid argon nucleus recoils, chemistry happens in the argon, and you get very extreme X-ray, or extreme ultraviolet radiation, which we convert to blue and measure. So we need liquid argon. Liquid argon is liquid at about, 87 Kelvin. It freezes solid at 83. That's a key number. We have, how do you cool liquid argon? Well, we use liquid nitrogen as a buffer. And the reason we use liquid nitrogen is it doesn't go away when the power goes out, or at least it goes away very slowly. If you're using a fridge, as soon as the power goes out, you lose cooling. Okay, we have many hours of buffer cooling even if the power goes out. So what do we do in our experiment? Well, what we did, we started doing on July 3, is we took argon gas from a cylinder, ran it through a bunch of filters. This valve was open, that was closed. The argon was forced through here, through the liquid nitrogen where it liquefied, and dripped into here. There's heat loads on the system, of course, so our argon is very slowly boiling away too. While we filled, we just vented it away. Right now, it's running. This valve is closed. This valve's open. The argon that comes up comes through here and reliquifies, and we have a closed-loop system. Okay. Now, there's a problem. Liquid nitrogen is a liquid at mine pressure, which is about 18 psi instead of 15 on the surface. The nitrogen would be about 79 Kelvin. That would freeze the argon solid. So, and of course, if you freeze the argon solid, it doesn't flow and pressures build up and then it vents and that's bad. No one gets hurt, but it's bad for the experiment. So the way we keep the argon warm is we put pressure on it, right? Just, you know, like pressure cooker. We add about 15 psi gauge, so the absolute pressure is 33 psi. It comes in at 86 Kelvin. But of course, in the process of all of this, we're taking heat out of the argon, putting it into the nitrogen. It's boiling away. So we need an external reservoir with a filling system. Okay, great. A few pictures of what this experiment actually, looks like. Here's the steel frame holding it. Here's some of the cryogenics getting installed in the early days. Here's a great picture. We need to get the light out to measure the light, and we've got some acrylic plastic, protects against neutrons. Light guides that we use to get light out, and this is Beikai polishing them and preparing them. This is what the experiment looked like actually on July 3, too, although this is an earlier picture. It's surrounded by boxes of water as shielding, and with a hole there so we could get the detector for our work. And then this is everything filled in, and that's Q, whose blog I mentioned earlier. So on July 3, we had everything pumped out. Our argon system was completely pumped out at vacuum, completely clean. The detector was at room temperature, and we started filling. So what happens is we liquefy the argon. It goes into the warm detector. It boils off. It starts cooling. And we just left it filling, and overnight, the detector got cold, and it actually started accumulating liquid argon. So on July 4, the part I left off is when I got up and had my coffee, I went and looked and noticed that we had two external nitrogen supplies. And I noticed that the one we were using was almost empty, so I switched to the second one on computer control. And caught the 630 cage underground. The one difference is we actually have to work on a schedule, which is annoying. But and in the lab at 7:15, so there's a hit to the day. Right? I mean, there's 45 minutes of getting to work from the time I arrive at work. I put on my mind gear that you saw in the video, and 45 minutes, I'm ready to work. So the three of us got underground, Hugh, Luke, and I. And at about 7:05, the second system that I switched to started failing. And so the first thing we had to deal with is, why did that system fail? And we guessed the reason, and we fixed it, and it's too bad we guessed wrong. What happened? Here's fill system number one and fill system number two. Actually, can we fill the lights again? And so here's an automatic valve that lets the nitrogen from here into the detector, and this valve failed. When we put in the fix, we tested it right away. And nothing happened, except we heard a click, 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 click sound. This is bad. That's not a valve opening. That's a valve trying to open. It actually turns out that we had this valve in backwards. They're unidirectional valves, and oops. And even worse, remember the nitrogen up here on the other side of this hose? We have to keep it at high pressure, right? 15 psi, or bad things will happen. Our argon will freeze a plug and we'll lose the ability to flow argon. And so we needed to fix this problem, but there was no manual valve to seal off the system when we did that. So that was kind of fun. I got to put on gloves and a face shield and prepare the plug which fit in the plumbing and then take this off. And as cold nitrogen gas was hissing out, put in a plug. That was exciting. It worked. It was exciting. The other thing actually I want to point out is you'll notice every valve that we use is tagged, what number valve and stuff it is, and I'll get to that in a minute. So as the detector was filling and we started accumulating argon in it, we're able to measure signals. And so our data was automatically being sent to a computer farm at Queen's University, and automated analyses were starting. So Luke, the summer student, was making a series of plots from data as it streamed in, as did the postdoc at Queen's, who was polishing the acrylic you saw earlier. And there were lots of phone calls back and forth. And the reason I mentioned that, that's one of the features of these types of experiments, is that they're worked on by people who are very geographically diverse. So you use the phone and, you know, web tools and whatnot a lot. But the upshot of this is between the summer students and the postdoc at Queen's, sort of one, we knew at least that the data taken an hour ago or 2 hours ago was good. And by good, that means the argon was pure. There were no contaminants in the argon affecting the signals. So we finished filling. The detector finished at about 1 o'clock in the afternoon on that day, and that was surprisingly close to schedule given that the nitrogen fail effectively caused us to stop for 2 hours. So then we had 4 hours to fill in the shielding. The reason actually we only had 4 hours to fill in the shielding, what made this day particularly exciting, is the mining company does a shutdown for maintenance, and we weren't able to get into the lab for the next 14 days. So we had that day to get it done, or we didn't. So we spent a bunch of time fielding shielding, and we fit plastic blocks around the detector. and we have to stack 22-liter boxes of water. So what I've said sounds a little ad hoc and a little chaotic, and it was kind of partly. We did lots of prep and planning, and one thing, so this is, I just took, this is actually our checks July 3rd before we went in, and our procedures July 3rd. We had 10 pages of this, of basically pre-thought out, reviewed by everybody in the collaboration on phone calls, sets of procedures. So obviously you're not going to read this, but the point is we did prep a lot, and we knew a lot of what was going on. And actually one of the reasons we were able to solve the problem is that, and have this fill work, is that because the three previous fills didn't work, I didn't mention that, but yeah, the previous three attempts we introduced some contaminant, and we really bulletproofed the procedures and went over everything and made sure that, that the mistakes we were making didn't get made again. So yeah, there was a lot of prep and planning into this as we developed these procedures and made them better. So the question, why did I pick this day other than it ended up working and we started taking data and everything was ended up being successful? This day had a lot of features. Okay, so I got to work with a grad student, Hugh from Yale, an undergrad, Luke from Laurentian, with people off-site, Bay the postdoc at Queens, and I didn't mention the engineers and techs who did a lot of stuff for us that day. So those are the people, you get to work with people from all over, and lots of work with students. We plumbed, we took a pipe wrench and we fixed plumbing. We followed procedures extremely carefully, and we also improvised, depending on what was going on, and we took data and we analyzed it. So, you know, that was 12 hours of work that was concentrated, if you like, and it was pretty intense. It was more like a few ordinary days rolled into one. But that's what we do, and it's one of the reasons I really like my job, is that we do all sorts of different kinds of things at any one time. So, stop there.
Thanks, Chris. A few of us were lucky enough to go down to Snow Lab a couple years ago, so it's kind of fun to watch that thing. I'll do some questions.
Yes. You use carbon tetrafluoride as a target?
Okay, the castle people
or something.
Pick a C4F10.
Okay, well, but it's normal matter. It's to detect the existence of dark matter.
Right.
But somewhere there's an interaction between this stuff and normal matter. So somewhere, in my view, dark matter has to show up as normal matter. What is the evidence for dark matter?
Okay. Again, all the evidence for dark matter so far is indirect evidence, the cosmological evidence. So there are two general, well, we're looking for a certain kind of dark matter, the formula I gave, that it be massive, and by massive I mean about 100 times the mass of the proton. And that it interacts weakly, okay? And by weak interactions, that's the same interactions that neutrinos do. So there are known to be weak interactions between, say, neutrinos and various atoms. The term for this, since it's a weakly interacting massive particle, is actually what we're doing is looking for lamps.
But it's an assumption, or is it evidence-based?
Both.
Both.
And you can come up with, it's an educated assumption.
Okay.
You can come up with other models of work. If there is dark matter 4 times more than ordinary matter in the universe, it had to get created somehow in the early universe. And to get the right amount created, the interaction strengths to create it, and to have it also get created with the right strength, and then decouple from the rest of the universe so it can start clumping, it sets a range of what the interaction strengths can be. That's completely consistent with the typical weak interaction strengths. Okay? We don't know what it is, but it's in a certain range. So that's an educated assumption. The other thing, too, is there are four known forces in the universe, and it matches one. Okay? So the stuff interacts gravitationally with the weak interaction. So there's a reasonably good evidence to think it's weakly interacting. If it is weakly interacting, you can calculate how it should interact with atoms. You may not know completely the probabilities, and there's still, scaling constants that you can put in, but you know how it should interact with atoms. So the reason fluorine is used is it's an atom with the nuclear spin, and the Picasso experiment is looking for an interaction between a WIMP, which has angular momentum, which has spin, and the angular momentum of fluorine atom. The argon experiments, or the other noble experiments, are just looking for an elastic scatter, basically a billiard ball scatter. And so if you have something with 100 times the mass of a proton hitting argon, that's roughly, you're looking for an elastic scatter, you know what the kinematics of the recoiling argon is, so you know how it should work in the argon. The other thing you know is that the Earth is, thanks to the Sun, is moving through the galaxy at about 220 kilometers a second. The dark matter is on average stationary. It means our detector is hitting dark matter at 220 kilometers a second, which is the other thing you need to know to make the kinematics work.
How do we know dark matter is not orbiting?
There are worse problems than that. I mean, it could be, but again, probably not. The dark matter would have started clumping out much earlier. The real issue, the assumption people make, is what is the distribution of dark matter in the galaxy? And that's a much tougher thing to work out.
It's a really mean question, Chris, but why have we found it? There's lots of experiments going on.
Yeah, and there's lots of experiments going on at other places. Why haven't we found it? When you do these experiments, okay, let's say, take the case of liquid argon, you're looking for an elastic scatter off of liquid argon. So there's two variables that affect how hard your argon is recoiled. One is how fast the wind is traveling, which tells you or how massive it is. We know how fast it's traveling. It's 220 kilometers a second. How much mass it's got, how much momentum it has relative to the argon nucleus. The other thing is just what are the odds? How big does an argon atom look to a WIMP? We know roughly the scale of that. By roughly the scale of that, I mean there's many, many orders of magnitude to play with. So the optimistic answer to the question is because the interaction, the size of an argon atom is just to a WIMP particle is just slightly too small to have been measured so far. And I say slightly because, of course, we want to be able to measure it. But one of the reasons we want to scale up, right, the best limits right now is on 10 kilograms of xenon or for some masses or 2.5 kilograms of germanium, the CMS experiment. We want to scale up to tons so that we radically increase the probability that we get an event. And also we want to be very, very much cleaner so that we keep decreasing the probability of what we see as background.
You keep talking about an elastic scattering event of a WIMP against an argon, but this is via the weak nuclear force, right?
Right.
Could you please try and explain how does the weak nuclear force work? Is it repulsive?
Yes.
Is it attractive?
Yes.
Can you explain it as a force?
Sure. Let me draw a picture of something. Let's pick one thing that is, I'm going to start with a very clean, clear example and then a more complicated one. If you have a neutrino
coming. Stay. Tells me to be gentle.
You pull down a little further, it might stay. It's a little stuck.
Right, so you have a neutrino, and you have an electron. The electron could be in snow, it could be in you, whatever. The neutrino and the electron, the way these things work in particle physics is they will exchange a particle between them. And because of the magic of quantum mechanics, that can pull them closer together or throw them farther apart, depending on what's going on. And the neutrino can travel like this, and the electron keeps going. In this situation, the electron stays an electron, the neutrino stays an electron. So whatever particle is going through here must be neutral, and that's called the Z particle. Z naught, C0 for the Americans in the audience. The other thing that could happen, actually, with an electron, and is actually more likely to happen, is the neutrino can come in, turn itself into an electron, electron. So this is actually how the Kamioka experiment works. Turns out this is about 6 times more likely than this. And only electron-type neutrinos can do this, but any type of neutrino can do that. So basically, the way the weak force works is you exchange a particle between two things. This is not different than other forces. Okay, so if you have an electron scattering off of a proton, they exchange a particle, that's the photon, and the electron can go one way and the proton can go the other way. Okay, it's the same thing. Now the reason the electromagnetic force is big in our lives is that the photon weighs nothing, so this can take place over an appreciable distance. This thing weighs, roughly 100 times what a proton weighs. Okay, so if you're going to create a particle that weighs something heavy, even a virtual particle, you have to give it back. You can borrow that much energy for a certain length of time. Delta E, delta T has to be less than H bar. But this particle can only go a very short distance, really, before it has to get reabsorbed. And that means that the force is extremely short range. And you have to get very, very, very close to have it happen. Or effectively, an electron looks small to a neutrino. An electron looks absolutely enormous to another electron because they're sending photons back and forth over a large distance. Okay. A WIMP, we call it Chi because we don't know what else to call it, comes in. We've got an argon nucleus, and again. It would, if it's weak, interact with the same kind of force, and that would cause the argon. And when I say an elastic scatter, I just mean energy is conserved, right? You're not doing any kind of, you're not changing the argon into something else. So at the end of this interaction, if you just look here and here, the argon would just start recoiling away, and you would measure that. Since you're doing the quantum thing, I'll mention one of the things that makes this type of measurement possible is as your dark matter particle is moving in at 220 kilometers per second, it's the Broglie wavelength, is larger than an argon atom. So it interacts with all the argon atom, all the argon nucleus at once. Sorry, its wavelength is larger than an argon nucleus. So it's actually not interacting with 20 protons and 20 neutrons. It's interacting with all 40 at once, which is 1,600 times bigger than one mass.
So from a force point of view, the argon has a very short range repulsive force on the dark
Yeah, if you like, yes. And so they have to get very, very, very close together to feel this force. Mm-hmm. But if they do, they can. And so the odds of getting very, very, very close together, and basically that has units, very, very, very close together has units of area. Right, the argon atom has a certain area, and the dark matter particle must get a certain distance, you know, must, if you like, from the center for that force to be felt.
An interaction cross section.
Yes, yes.
But it's always repulsive, it's not going to attract.
In this case, yes, it's an elastic scatter. No, I don't want to say that. The argon will move. It will get some of the energy.
So you're talking about a neutral ether, so it's a, there's no charging on here.
Yeah, yes. Yeah, dark matter better not be charged or we'd have seen it. Because if dark matter were charged, it wouldn't be dark. It would light up and interact electromagnetically.
And we're presuming it has no strong force interaction.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. If it had a strong force interaction, boy, would we see it. Because the strong nuclear force is strong. dark matter is dark. Yes, the strong nuclear force is strong. Yeah, sorry. That's just how it is.
We have time for one more question. Sorry, Sean, we're going to go with the far guy. So, Barry G. Farther. So, he has a question. Better be a good
thanks. I'm interested in the hypothesis for the existence of dark matter beyond an individual galaxy. Given the evidence based on the orbital rotation of stars at the periphery, I would have thought centrifugal acceleration would have required the dark matter to be centrally located within the galaxy. What evidence do we have?
Quite the opposite. Velocity versus R. If the mass were centrally located, okay? You know how to do this, right? The force is, and that has to be the centrifugal acceleration, right? So you do the math, right? And the velocity has to fall off, okay? What happens in the rotation curve of the galaxy does that, and it doesn't fall off. Meaning, as you go farther out, it's not centrally located mass, because centrally located mass is what would bring this curve down. It's as you get further out, these stars far at the outside edge of the galaxy are feeling a whole lot more gravity pulling them in than they should, and that lets them travel faster. And they're feeling a whole lot more gravity than they should, we believe, because there's dark matter out there, extra dark matter farther out is pulling them in. So the dark matter is much larger than the galaxy.
And the pattern of the density?
The pattern of the density can be constrained a little bit farther out, but nobody really knows, and there's arguments over it. So when you're comparing experiments and results, there's an agreed upon distribution that everyone uses, just so that, you can go from one to the other if you need to, but you kind of pick one to compare. So that when experiment A compares with experiment B, you say under the assumption of that's a distribution of dark matter in the galaxy.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right.
Well, thank you very much.